So, does work define us, or is it just a source of income? Do our jobs leave us broken and empty, or do they actually fill a void? Do we even have realistic expectations about our careers, or are we setting ourselves up for failure? Are we born dreamers who just can't stop dreaming, or have we blindly accepted our fate? Let's be honest, at some point, we've all asked these questions. Maybe last week, or last year, or maybe right now. You're not alone. My name is Rocco Lungarello. I am a professional writer who has been plagued with these questions from the inception of my career. And though I've been on a personal exploration to find answers, I think it's time to shut off my brain, strike up some meaningful conversations, and find out once and for all that the answers to these questions have always lied within those that surround us. Our co-workers, our brothers, our friends, our wives. This is Where I Work, a podcast long overdue. So shut off your television and open your ears.
So yeah, what is your name and what do you do?
I'm John and I work for the Department of Veterans Affairs as a field examiner.
What is that?
So working as a field examiner, anybody who receives VA benefits, whether it's a pension or a compensation.
VA.
VA, the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Veterans Affairs, okay.
So anybody who receives money, a compensation, pension, there's a whole bunch of different programs, and they're rated by their doctor that they're unable to handle their own funds. We need to appoint someone to do it, whether it's a family member, an attorney, somebody who can we can hold responsible to handle their money and then give it to them as they see fit, whether it's paying rent, food, anything like that. And then we do audits and check every year to make sure that that money's not being misused on the veterans or the beneficiary that's receiving the money.
So you're looking out for the veterans' best interest?
Yes.
Okay.
So I go out and I meet with the veterans, and then what we first do is make sure that they can't handle their monies. So
what would be the reasons?
Sometimes they may have dementia, some kind of mental impairment, drugs and alcohol, that they're just spending it on that and not keeping a roof over their head. So maybe during that time period to help them, if they had a stroke, anything like that, that may cause somebody to not be able to handle their own funds. I go out there, I'll meet with a family member, and we do a background check on them, you know, credit check, background check, do an interview. We get down all the money that they make, all the assets, stuff like that, call character witnesses, make sure that they're a good fit, and then we appoint them. And then we make sure they're not misusing the money every year after that. They do accountings and stuff like that.
So misusing money that is given to them by the government.
Yes.
So you
for the veterans.
So basically somewhat like an auditor
for
the IRS, but also like a social worker.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Do you have a background in any of that, in social work?
I don't, not in social work, but I do in law enforcement, so it's more like an investigative than social worker side.
Okay.
We do more background investigations, more auditing, making sure that, you know, funds are not being diverted or anything like that, and it's all going to the veteran.
Is it like, you know, a happy accident when you discover that there's, you know, foul play, or are you looking for those things?
We're always looking for those things. We're always looking for those things. I'd say maybe 0.5% of the time we find stuff like that. It doesn't happen often.
Okay.
Most of the time you find children or somebody that's, and when I say children, I mean these are grown adults taking care of their 80 to 90 year old parents that have only their best interest in heart, and you know it's very easy to do.
Okay.
You can just tell. I mean, after working, prior to doing this, I worked as a federal police officer and Air Force, and dealing with people every day that lie to you, you just kind of get that feeling of who's being honest with you, and almost instantly you can tell. I don't know, doing this job for so long.
What are some of the things, like, how do you know if I'm lying to you, if you're interrogating me about something?
Most of it is just, I do this thing, and if I've always been taught this, that, so when I worked as a police officer and I was trying to get a story from somebody, I would ask the same question probably 5 to 6 times, just in different ways. And if their story starts to divert anyway, you know that there's some kind of lie going on.
Okay.
Because anybody who's lying, they can't keep that same story correct. If it's not a legitimate story, it's going to differ a little bit here and there. And then once you start picking those up, the difference in the stories, you start harping on those and asking more and more.
Okay. And yeah, that
makes
sense. The
story will change.
So you were in the Air Force, right?
Air Force, yes.
Okay. How old were you when you decided to join the Air Force?
So I decided sophomore year that I was going into the Air Force. I always wanted to be a police officer. That's what I wanted to do come high school. I think it was after watching Office Space that I knew I was never going to work a corporate job. I never wanted to work a corporate job. It just wasn't me to sit in a desk and push papers for any reason. So everyone in our school, I mean, we grew up right next to each other in Trumbull, Connecticut, and everybody was going to college. That was it. You were going to college, and that's all you did. There was really no
other choice. There was no alternative.
There was no alternative.
But I think also, too, we come from, like, blue collar, and our parents didn't go to college, and
exactly.
It was, like, really important that we did.
Absolutely.
And we didn't know why,
yeah.
You know. But anyway.
So I just knew school wasn't for me. High school, I was terrible. I did, you know, I was probably like a CD student. I remember my mom used to joke. She used to call me High C because that's basically was my grades in high school.
Yeah.
I just didn't. It wasn't that I wasn't smart. I just didn't care. Like, I just didn't want to do the work. It wasn't me at the time.
Yeah.
But
you didn't get in trouble. You weren't like acting, you know, right?
Never acting up. Nothing. I just didn't like doing the work. It just wasn't appealing to me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't know how else to explain that. But I went on to get my bachelor's when I got and I got my master's and. I think I received 3 or 4 B's my entire college career. Everything else was A's because it was definitely because of the military, yeah.
Well, because you were interested in it, though, too.
Yeah, after.
So you have 2 degrees right now?
Yes, yeah.
What are they in criminal justice?
Yeah, they're both justice administration. I went to WestCon for my first one. As soon as I got in the military, they paid for it, so it's kind of dumb not to go to school.
That's in Danbury?
Danbury, yes. Got that, and almost immediately I was hired by the VA as a police officer. So I did that for about 5 years. And as I was working that, I was working midnight shifts. We were trying to make extra money working overtime. And I got an email from my old professor, and they just started a master's degree program.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, did you ever think about going for your master's? And I was like, no, not really. He says, well, since you came here and you did so well, we can get rid of, you know, we can... write off 2 or 3 classes. So all I had to do was get 10 more classes to get my master's. So
yeah.
Why not do
yeah,
that?
Yeah, that's awesome.
And at the time, I was still getting the VA. The VA has a benefit, the 9/11 GI Bill, where they paid me almost $1,600, $1,700 a month tax-free to go to school. I don't have any student loans, nothing like that.
Okay.
So instead of working overtime and doing all that, I'd rather just go to school and make the extra money there. So I did it. It took about 2 years or so, and I got my master's.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's in the same thing. It's in Justice Administration, but MSJA, but...
Yeah.
I guess.
So back in high school, did you always know... As you said, you always knew you wanted to be a police officer. Was the route then the military? Well, what...
So the reasoning behind that, my dad was in the Army. He always told me stories. I remember seeing photos and you know, all that, and I thought it was pretty cool to do that. Being that I was 18, you couldn't become a police officer until you're 21. And you can legally carry a firearm. So knowing myself and knowing how much I didn't like school, what was I going to do between 18 and 21 years old?
Okay.
Except for get in trouble and work terrible jobs. So I figured, you know what? Let me go into the military. I'll do that for 4 years. Maybe I can work. And I did. I worked as a military police officer, security forces in the Air Force for that time. And I figured, you know, when I'm done, I'll get out and I'll have at least a resume starting to be built when I get out at 22 years old.
Okay. What year did you go enter the military?
2001. I actually enlisted July 17th, 2001. That's 3 months before 9/11.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I remember that. I mean, like, you're basically like my brother. You know, we've known each other
yes.
since you were one. Like, I remember the thought, like, holy shit, John's in the military.
Yeah.
And, like, it scared the fuck out of us.
I think it scared everybody. I mean, when I went in July. I made sure it was July, too. That was my first entry date. I didn't even spend a month out of my summer vacation until I went in. So I wanted to go right in. I didn't want to take any time. And I went to San Antonio, Texas. Now, I don't know if anybody's been to San Antonio, Texas in July, but it's like 130 degrees every day. It's terrible. So we fly in. your whole entire world of what you've done between, you know, a child and 18 years old just all comes crashing down, and you're just like in this zone of just...
Feels like hell.
Yeah, it feels like hell. You don't know where you are. You're confused. You're scared.
And you're 18.
And you're 18.
Looking back now, which is a child,
right? A child. Mm-hmm. You are. You were an absolute child. And I just remember people just running around, just incoherently, just couldn't get it together. That night, we get in bed. It's probably like 4 o'clock in the morning now. And we know we're getting woken up at, you know, 6 o'clock or 5:30.
So no one slept, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I'm laying in bed. And this was the first time I actually meet anybody that lives outside of Connecticut. And my bunkmate right next to me, he introduced himself. And he shook my hand. And he said, we're going to do this. We're going to shake hands every night until we're done. And it was just like, it was that at the time, knowing that somebody else was with you in this, it really felt good. And we started all connecting and like getting this bond that you just never had before. And every night we shook hands, the two of us, until...
Just to say we're in this together.
Yeah, we're in this together. And another night is done.
Awesome. I mean, because you're away from your family for the first time of your life.
First time ever. First time ever. And they take away, at the time, there was no cell phones. I mean, 2001 to 2005 is when cell phones really started coming out.
Yeah.
So I didn't even own a cell phone or anything like that. But if you had one, which I think 3 or 4 people did, they take them away. They don't let you watch the news. They don't let you look at newspapers. You are contained in this area, and that's it. That's all you know is the people around you, mm-hmm. and a couple letters that you get every night from.
So your basic training took place in San Antonio for 8 weeks.
For 8 weeks. And then I did another, I think it was 10 to 15 weeks of the police academy in San Antonio.
So do you have to wake up at like 5 in the morning and run 3 miles? Like, what's that? What kind of stuff goes on?
Every morning we would wake up. We got these little flashlights and our uniforms on, and we'd have to be lined up. They start that reveille, that dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun.
Yeah.
So as soon as that goes on, you hear it. You have the time before that song ends to be dressed, downstairs, lined up with your flashlight, and ready to go. There was no showering yet or anything like that, so we all fired down. Our beds had to be made, and we'd leave these little cards. They're called 341s. It had your name, everything like that. And if your bed wasn't made correctly and they walked through, they would pull your 341. And you don't want your drill instructor to get that 341 because it was just over. So when you would come back, you'd hope to God that 341 was still on your bed, meaning that it was made correctly.
Got it.
So we'd all fire down. You have to make your bed, be ready. And then we would go run and just do PT for about a half hour, maybe an hour or
What's
so.
What's that, PT?
So about physical training. So it was what they call Indian running. We would do this for a half hour straight.
Clothes off?
I don't even know if you can say Indian running anymore, but that's
yeah, Native American running.
It's funny because my daughter takes dancing, and they were what we know is Indian style. It's called crisscross applesauce now. Did you know
the
this?
Way you sit?
Yeah, you're not allowed to say Indian.
Oh, it's politically
Indian style
incorrect.
Anymore, yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, so we did these.
Wait, what? Applesauce? What
crisscross is applesauce?
Wow.
Yeah. So, anyways. So we do these things called Indian runs. It'd be a half hour, and you'd line up. There'd be like, I don't know, say 10 of you in a line.
Yeah.
And you'd run around a track, the quarter mile track. And the person all the way in the back would have to sprint to the front, and then they would stand in the front, and then the guy in the back would now have to sprint. And you guys would not stop moving, so the guy in the back would have to sprint the 10 people go in the front. And this would go on for a half hour, just nonstop running. It was terrible because I'm not a runner. I hate running. And then we do the PT, the push-ups, the sit-ups, the stretching, the flutter kicks, everything like that. So we'd probably do that for, I would say, approximately an hour. And then we'd go eat breakfast. So they would give us 2 minutes. I'm not even making this up. I wish I was making this up. We'd be lined up. They say you have 2 minutes to go up, shower, and get back down.
Two minutes.
And be ready to eat. Yeah. 2 minutes.
120 seconds.
Yeah, and there's 60 people in each thing. And we had what they called a horseshoe shower thing. So everyone had to shower. These weren't even real showers. I mean, they were... It was like a horseshoe shape. So picture a locker room as a horseshoe, right?
Yeah.
So everybody would line up. You'd literally fly up the stairs, undress, run into the shower. And as you're running into the shower, you're not even wet yet. You're putting shampoo in your hair, and you're starting to suds down. So it's ridiculous. So it would go like this, a horseshoe shape. the first guy would start going in there, and they would just go, you know, 3 seconds each shower head you had, and you just kept going like that, just trying to suds down. You'd get out, you'd have soap in your hair still. You're just trying to get yourself,
oh my God,
taken care of. And then we'd have to get dressed, and then be down there ready to eat. And that's what we would do.
Why do you think they... What's the purpose of that, of the treatment to, of the soldiers?
Well, at the time, you don't know what the... You're like, why can't we just have 5-10 minutes? And it's because they want you to follow orders. They want you just to get stuff done. Because in a combat situation or anything, they don't want you to be complaining. They don't want you to say... Like, if I said, can you take a shower in 2 minutes? Right now, you're dressed. Go shower and come back and be ready to go for the day. You'd probably say no, because it's an impossible task. They want you to look at stuff like that and say, that's not impossible. Anything is possible. You can just get it done.
Okay.
Just put your mind to it and get it done and work together.
Got it.
So a lot of these tasks, they knew you wouldn't be able to do it, but they want you to, you know, I guess just get it done any way possible.
That makes sense.
Just make it happen and do it together.
Did you ever, how did you think you handled it?
I handled it well, and in a lot of it, I credit my father, because he told me, he went through it, and he said...
He kind of
exact words. He said, yeah, it's all bullshit. He says, don't volunteer for anything. He goes, don't make your name known. He says, just stay back and listen and do what everybody else is doing. So I kind of played that role and just did exactly what they told us to do. You know, stayed out. Don't be the comedian. Don't do any of that. Just get your stuff done, and that's it. And I was left alone. I really didn't have...
That's good advice.
Yeah. There was one time... This is a good story. So... A lot of the things they want to do is test you to make sure that you can handle a stressful situation and, you know, stay cool. So we used to have a locker and then a drawer. Our drawer had this towel that we had to fold just perfectly to fit. Our deodorant had to be a certain way. Our toothbrushes. Everything had a perfect spot to be in, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we would get inspections on this. So we'd stand next to our locker, and the drill instructor came by, and he was checking everybody's. Mine was perfect. I knew it was perfect. He looked in it. He goes, perfect drawer. He goes, but I see a piece of lint. So he reaches down. He grabs the towel that's on the bottom and lifts it up. The whole thing. Everything goes flying. All my toiletries, everything, to the ground. And he says, I got it. Don't worry. And he moved on. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to rattle you. They want you to get upset. They want to see something, you know? But you had to just stay cool. You just had to just, you know, keep your eyes forward, pretend like it didn't happen, and then when he left, go clean it up and put it back. So it was a lot of those mind games that you constantly had going on to see, and I think they were just testing you to see how you would react to leadership later on, maybe giving you an order or doing something that you did not like. So,
do you think you gained anything out of that you kind of put in practice today, or was it all just
absolutely
BS?
Everything that I learned in the military, which is, I always say that it saved my life. If I didn't go into the military, I probably would have been the same kid in high school, you know, just barely making it through with C's and just kind of getting through life. What I did learn, and this is one thing that I always take away, is that we used to live not day by day or week by week. We used to live meal by meal. And this was, it always worked. Because when you start thinking of big pictures of life, when people say, set a goal, what's your goal 5 years from now? It gets overwhelming to think about that. You know, how am I going to get from where I am now to where I want to be in 5 years?
Yeah.
And you start thinking, you know, that's way too much work. I can't do that. That's just, it gets overwhelming. I remember one of your podcasts you had, one individual was talking about, he's just tired. He just doesn't want to do it anymore. He didn't have the energy to do what he really wants to do because it's just too much work.
Yeah.
But if you look at today and 5 years from now, how you're going to get it done, it gets overwhelming. So we used to break it down meal by meal. So when we were in there, we'd say, you know, we got breakfast done. Let's get to lunch, guys. And we would work. And that's all. We would take little bites of stuff. And it would be a lot more manageable when you're just working to get to lunch. Then everyone's like, okay, we're done with lunch. Let's make it to dinner time.
That's an awesome approach.
It is, and I still use that to this day. I mean, life throws so many curveballs, and you know, I used to always set goals, and goals are just, you really can't. You have to just kind of know where you want to go and just let life take you where it's going to take you.
Yeah,
because you really can't fight it. Just take it bit by bit when you get overwhelmed.
The thing that's funny is I could be wrong, but I think a lot of the times the way it's presented to you when you're growing up or getting older is you need goals. You have to achieve. And I think I sometimes struggle with anxiety, and from what I've read, it's a lot of it is because you're living too much in the future.
Exactly.
You know, you're not really focusing on the present. And I think I never even thought of that approach where meal by meal, I mean, that's kind of really extreme, but it's more like, yeah, you have goals to some extent, but you're more or less focusing on the now, exactly. if you can. And I probably would have benefited from that. So you really, like, you take that approach with you today?
I do. Let's say everybody knows that whoever went to college, you get a syllabus. And you look at that syllabus, and the first thing you're doing is to see how many papers you have, how many tests you have. And you start looking at it, and you're like, oh, my God.
Dude, freak yourself out.
I don't want to do this. I'm going to drop this class. They have a 10-page paper. I mean, for you, it's nothing because you're, you know, but I don't like writing. And I was like, ugh, and I don't want to take this class. But then you take that approach, you know, test by test, day by day, and it gets done. It's very simple when you take stuff in small little sections at a time. Yeah, so I took that in college, and it worked really well. I wasn't dropping classes because it had a 10-page paid, you know, at the end of the semester due or anything like that.
Yeah, that's great. I like that approach. So I want to go back to 2001.
Okay.
So you joined the military, and you started out in July. What happened? Where were you when all that stuff went down on September 11th?
So I just finished basic, and before I went into my tech school, the date, I had like 2 weeks in between. So they were doing this new program where they did like a study skills program to kind of help you learn and teach you how to study before you went into this class. So it was like an intermediate 2 weeks before I went into my, their equivalent to police academy. Mm-hmm. So it was early that morning. We just got up, you know, we were sitting around waiting for the class to start. And mind you that I haven't watched the TV, haven't seen news, haven't seen anything.
Or any of your people you're with. Yeah.
And before I went in too, I mean, before I went in, I was always like, you know what, there hasn't been a war since, you know, I think it was, you know, Desert Storm that lasted an hour and a half, I believe it was. So that was the last thing we ever saw. So I was like, you know, what's the chances of another war or anything happening? So I should be okay, you know, for my 4 years of enlistment. So we're sitting there, and the first plane hits the tower. And they started turning on TV. So like I said, it was like, what are they doing? They're turning on news? Like, we haven't seen a TV in... or newspaper or anything in the last 8 weeks. And they let us gather around them. Like, we were all at that time where it was the instructors, drill instructors, you know, and then there was little old us.
You were still in basic at that point.
Yeah, like, all that kind of went out the window for that 4 or 5 hours that we were watching this unfold, like, the towers being hit, and we're all, like, it's just crazy watching that on watching that on the TV with them, almost like a peer, like we're all together now. Because we all knew that from here on out, we didn't know what the future was going to hold. And it just got real. And I think the worst part about the whole thing was that academy that I got into a week later was the most serious thing I've ever seen. Because these guys now knew, these guys that are going into this academy have a good chance of actually going over and fighting. And, you know, it's a whole new world. It's not your mundane job that they've done. You know, they're military instructors. They're the same thing as you and I. They go to work, they get it done, and then they come home. You know, a lot of them, I'm sure, phone it in or whatever. But for that next 10 weeks, nobody was. They knew how serious it was. So I think we went through one of the worst classes that you could have, just because they were so hard on us on everything, knowing that the future, you know, it was going to happen.
You weren't deployed anywhere.
I wasn't, thank God. It's a funny story. When they were giving out orders at the end, so after that 10 weeks went by, they were giving out orders saying who was going where, and people were going overseas. And a lot of times what happens is once you get deployed, you're going to start over in Germany, and they'll deploy you from there and stuff like that. So they were calling out orders. People were getting, you know, Ramstein, Germany, Ramstein, Spangalen, like all these places overseas. And I was like, oh my God. And they're like, Minot. And I was like, damn it, I'm going overseas. I didn't know where Minot was. And I said, where is Minot? And they're like, that's North Dakota. And I was like, where the hell is North Dakota? Yeah. Do you know where it is on a map?
I do.
Had no idea. I was like, North Dakota, where is that on a map? So I got stuck going up there. So I did 4 years there working with nuclear weapons, just because like you said in the earlier part of the podcast, that I never really got in trouble. So I was easy to get that secret clearance that we needed. And once I got in, I realized, and I started seeing all my secret clearance paperwork, the stuff I had to start signing, that they started this before my clearance. They knew where I was going before I even stepped foot into BMT.
Okay.
Like the second, like I think it was February, I logged in. That's when they started my background. So they basically knew that's where I was going. And we were non-deployable just because of our clearances and all that. They weren't letting us go because...
Did you want to go?
Overseas? Yeah. At the time, I did.
Yeah.
100%. Because North Dakota... It's a terrible place. It's cold. It's a tundra.
It's basically Canada.
It is. And that's where we spent most of our days, because to drink 18 is legal in Canada. And most of us were under 21. So we would drive a half hour north and we'd be fine.
Yeah.
So it was cold. And I remember one of the instructors, you know, this is later on. He said, North Dakota, huh? He goes, there's a pretty girl behind every tree out there. And I was like, cool. Because I was, you know, 18 years old. That's the exciting part. I get up there. There's not a damn tree in sight. It is so flat. You can stand on top of your car and see like 6 or 7 miles ahead of you. There's no trees. There's nothing.
Yeah.
It's just flat, flat land. And I was like, that son of a bitch.
But did you want to go? Because I remember during that time there were people, and I don't remember their names, but there were even like NFL players that like dropped out and wanted to go fight and like kill the terrorists and like all that shit was going on. Did you want to be a part of that, or were you kind of really excited or happy that you weren't involved in that mess?
Now I'm happy I didn't, because I see a lot of the guys who come back after they fought. But at the time, I mean, 18 years old, you can't get killed. Nothing bad can happen to you. So you were just fired up and everybody just wanted to go, and they were just holding us back. They just would not let anyone go from where we were.
Yeah.
But yes, everybody did.
What kind of duties did you have? You were a military police.
Yeah, it's military. The title was security forces, so it's basically a division between security and policing, and just depending on what base you got, what kind of clearance you had, is what you did.
What were you guarding something in North Dakota?
I was guarding nuclear missiles in North Dakota.
Really?
Yeah. So the ICBM missiles.
What's that stand for?
Minuteman III, intercontinent ballistic missiles. I'm going to say a lot of acronyms and a lot of things I don't even know what they mean. You just say them so often that just becomes another word. So ICBMs. ICBM missile is the missile that it's actually run by NASA, which is nice because we were funded by NASA. So in the Air Force, we had all the nice stuff because NASA was funding us just because of the ICBM missiles. So we had all the nice stuff. Whereas our counterparts on that base that were run by the Air Force, they had the Air Force budget, which wasn't as good. Anyways, these are the missiles that fire straight up. They go into orbit. The nuclear warhead or whatever breaks away. It orbits around, and then it finds its target and drops down. It's not the one that flies, you know, it's not on a plane and then drops them. It's not anything like that. It actually orbits.
So, those are obviously never used.
Yeah. But...
So you were in North Dakota the 4 years?
Yes. All 4 years. Well, 3.5 for the whole time.
And I mean, yeah.
The only way out of there was what they call is taking a remote, is going to Korea for a year. And then you get to pick whatever base you want. I had a good friend, actually my roommate. He wanted out. He did his tour in Korea. Then he wanted to go to Germany because it's beautiful out overseas. He did that for 2 years. And then he got sent to Maelstrom, which is the same thing, North Dakota. So once you're a missile cop, you're always a missile cop. Just having that clearance, it costs so much money and it takes so much time to get these people that they will send you back almost immediately.
Okay, that makes sense. So what happened? What did you do after your time was up there? What was the next step for you?
So I talked to my father, and you know he's always been really helpful with that, with stuff like that. And he told me, you know, don't stay in any longer. Come home. Go back to school, and if you want to go back in, go back as an officer. Don't stay enlisted. You have all this, you know, extra money and stuff for school, so just go to school. Come home, we'll take you back in. I didn't have to get a job or anything like that, and that's what I did. I went right to school. My wife, too, I met her 1 year before I left. I came home on leave. It was one of those things. We were hanging out at a bar. I knew her forever.
You go to high school?
I did. I went to high school with her. I always knew who she was. All our friends were the same people. So when I got home, and this was like a year on leave, we all went out and we met and we clicked. and we started going out, we started dating, we did the long distance relationship, and we were at the point before I left, you know, we were talking, maybe, you know, do we get married and stay in the military together, or do I get out and come home and we start there? So that had a big influence too, mm-hmm. you know, having her. And so Sarah and I just came home, we stayed together, and we got married.
Because she, did she kind of wanted you to come back?
She did, but she didn't. She kind of liked the idea of the two of us living a lifestyle, just staying in the military. So it was kind of up to me. She's always been good with, because with this lifestyle, the military policing, if you don't have a wife that understands your job, it's not going to work.
So you had a lot of support from your family.
Absolutely.
And from Sarah.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people probably, I feel like that's not common, right? The people that are in the military probably don't have that support.
Yes, I would say yes. A lot of, it's funny, just being, growing up in Trumbull, Connecticut your whole life, the world is so much different when you get down south. Just the people, everything. Like I said, there was maybe two or three people who joined the military out of high school, whereas down south, I would say probably half graduating classes. Most people you met were not from Connecticut or the Northeast at all.
Yeah.
They were, you know, from the South, and that's just what they did.
Yeah. It's not really, yeah, I guess just the part of the country that we lived in, it wasn't really a common thing to go to the military.
It wasn't.
We didn't really know many people who did.
I still don't. Yeah, most of my friends are from all over the country, at least South, Midwest, stuff yeah. like that.
So when you got back, you went back, you just, your dad kind of said, hey, you should go back to school. So you started taking full-time, you were enrolled.
Went full-time.
And so, you lived at home.
Yeah, and I lived at home. It went right back into the room that
so
I
So you were 22, right? Something like that.
22 years old. And I think that had a huge advantage of going to college at 22 years old, because most people who are going into college are 18, 19, where all they wanted to do was party and have fun and stuff like that. So when, yeah. I mean, you were a professor, so you know if a student is there, I was there every day, because there's, the military changes you when it comes to being on time places. They have this saying, it's called, if you're not 15 minutes early, you're 15 minutes late.
Right.
Have you ever heard this before?
Yeah, I have.
So in the military, they would tell you, you know, be here at 6 o'clock. God help you if you were there at 6 o'clock. You had to be there at 5:45.
My best students when I was an instructor at a community college in Ohio were all ex-military. Yeah. They were the best students.
And as a teacher, you see them coming in. You know they want to learn. So I think a lot of my grades came because of the amount of leeway the professors had. I mean, if you have a student asking you questions, actually doing work, showing up every day. I think I missed one or two classes my entire college career. I think that has a lot to do with it. And it helped me pass all my college classes, no problem.
What was your first job then after you got your undergrad in criminal justice?
Yes. So okay. I stuck with the plan. I wanted to be a police officer, so I stuck with it. And I started applying for jobs my last 6 months of school. I applied for a job with the VA. I graduated in May, and they offered me a job, I believe, in August, working as a federal police officer. I took that job. I still had a job, you know, I took a whole bunch of interviews and stuff with town police and state police and stuff like that, but the federal government offered me the job first, so I took the first one.
What was your role? What'd you do?
So I worked as a federal police officer with the Department of Veteran Affairs on the West Haven campus. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's a huge hospital.
I think I visited you there once.
You did. So it's a huge campus, and you basically handle any kind of crimes or anything that happens on that campus.
So your jurisdiction is that campus?
That campus.
You don't, if there's like something goes on across the street, not your problem?
Not our problem. Now they've extended the our jurisdiction to any crimes that originated on VA property and leaves VA property, we can follow. But at the time, it was like, that was it.
So you were like a guard, basically?
Basically. It was almost like what I did. It was half security, half policing. I mean, there's still a lot of stuff going on. I think there was 5,000 or 6,000 people who worked there, patients. They had a 24-hour psychiatric ward, people coming in. We saw a lot of stuff that you don't want to normally see.
Like
there was a lot of drug addicts.
Yeah.
So all the crimes that you see in a normal municipal department basically happens there too. I mean, they've had, you know, untimely deaths and all that kind of stuff that we have to handle on that campus as well.
So who is it people live in these campuses?
They don't live there, but it's a 24-hour facility. So a lot of them are inpatients where they don't leave for, you know, months.
And they're ex-military.
Ex-military.
Young guys.
young guys, and a lot of them. A lot of them were the younger guys coming back from overseas, you know, who fought in Afghanistan and stuff. PTSD, we see a lot of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it's very sad that having that military mentality, it's like a double-edged sword. And I've always said this, is that you were expected to go to work, whether you were sick. It didn't matter. You were going to work. So when these guys get out and they have problems with PTSD, any of these horrible things, they don't want to go to a doctor and get help. They're military. They know how to handle themselves. And it's one of those things that you can't handle by yourself. So a lot of them turn to drugs, alcohol. And by the time they walk into the VA for help, they're at the end of their rope. And it's a long road to, you know, recovery. But we would get these guys coming in off the street. Ambulance would bring them in. Maybe they had a fight with their girlfriend, or they're drunk or intoxicated. And then we would get them and kind of take them in and start rehabilitating them back to civilian.
So talk a little bit about what you do now. So you basically, something you kind of had a fire under your ass to get out of what you were doing because of why it wasn't appealing to you anymore. So
it wasn't just that it wasn't appealing. It was a schedule. So working as a police officer, and this is where I know you talked to a lot of your interviewees about your life to work ratio. What do you call it?
Work-life balance.
Work-life balance.
Yeah.
Work-life balance. There was no work-life balance. It was work. I was working midnight shifts, which I don't know if you've ever worked a midnight shift. They're absolutely terrible. You work the entire night. You get home. And at the time, we had, you know, 2-3-year-old. And I would get home, and I would just want to go to sleep. They were just waking up for breakfast. So I kind of have breakfast with them. I was half in and out. I would go lay down for, you know, 2 hours, fall asleep. I'd be wide awake because everything is going on during the day in the house. The lights are on. You know, the sun's up. And I would wake up, and I would kind of just live in this fog. And then by 10 o'clock, I would try to take another nap before I went to work. This would go on for months on end. I just couldn't handle it anymore.
Yeah.
So it just wasn't working out. I had enough of it after 5 years. Life changes dramatically when we had the baby. So things change, and I was just like, that's enough. And I started applying to different jobs, and that's how I found this job.
Okay.
And it worked out.
A field examiner.
Field examiner.
Do you like your job?
I love my job.
Yeah.
It could be, you know, I tell Sarah this all the time. It's definitely not my end game, but for the time, it's awesome. I love it. I love the working from home. I love having Saturday, Sunday off. I love having Christmas and waking up with the baby and not having to be at work. I can't even tell you how many Christmases I've missed in the military and working as a police officer. How many Thanksgivings, birthdays. I've missed them all. And I've really had enough of that. I just want to work a Monday through Friday, and that's it. So that had a huge...
Well, it helped you. It helped you appreciate the little things that most, you know, 9-to-5ers take for granted.
Exactly.
You know? So you've been... How long have you been a field examiner?
2 years now.
Yeah.
2 years I've been doing it.
So you work from home, that's
all the time. So where my human resources, I'm actually hired by Indianapolis, but we're outsourced. So I work for Connecticut. My boss lives in Rhode Island. And I have one of the best bosses in the world.
Yeah, that's a big part.
She's the kind of person, like, in the police department, if you did something, the next day when they got the report, it would be, why didn't you do it this way? Why didn't you do it this way? Why didn't you do it this way? Whereas this job, I do my report, I put it in, and my boss, I don't want to say she trusts us, but she knows that we know our job, and she leaves us alone. If I didn't call my boss, I'd probably hear from her maybe once a month or so.
Really?
Yeah. Like, I don't hear criticism, or she's just awesome. It just makes life so much better when you have a supervisor that trusts you and lets you get the job done.
Well, and I'm sure a lot of it too is that you're probably really good at your job and take it seriously and do your work, right?
I do. And it was, you know, working from home is tough at first because there's an adjustment period, but, you know, I have an office downstairs.
And you have to discipline yourself.
You do.
I work from home several days a week, and you really have to treat it that way. You know, exactly. You can't, like, watch TV or, like, you need an office. You have to be in the zone. You have to set your schedule and be really, I think only a certain, you have to have a certain personality to get it done.
You do.
You know, and I love it too.
I do.
But I think it's because it's the way you approach it, you know?
The only thing I miss, I mean, working from home is nice, but I work from home 5 days a week. We don't see anybody else, which is kind of I'm a very social person. I don't you miss that whole thing of like that camaraderie with guys and, you know, going to work and telling the off color jokes and just like all that kind of stuff. Yep. Like that doesn't happen anymore because I'm home. There's not like, it's not like I'm coming in and hanging out with people.
Yeah. I kind of have like a hybrid of that where I'll go in a couple days a week and get to be around people. And also the way technology is now, you could have conversations with people all the time or video conferencing and stuff. But yeah, I can see that. I don't think I would be good with an exclusive 9-to-5 always at home. I could get used to it, but I agree. I kind of like being around people, and I think also collaboration is easier sometimes when you're together.
Exactly. I'm not an email person. Everybody's email people nowadays. So, like, if they have a question, they'll email. I like actually calling people on the phone and talking to them and conversing.
It's pretty rare.
And now working from home, it's like you're even more secluded. So I like getting on that phone a little bit more. But
so from the beginning when you started that job, it was always remote, always from home?
Always. And that's why I picked the job. When I saw it, I didn't think I was going to get it. I thought there was no way. I didn't even know what the job was. I just figured, you know what, let me apply for it and we'll see what happens. And sure enough, I got that call back, which helped.
Good. Do you think you have... Because before you were saying you didn't have a work-life balance. Do you think you have that now?
Absolutely. Before, work was... That was it. It was work and family was secondary. I mean, working in the military, that's 100% what it is. Yeah, it's military first and then family or whatever you do second. That's your number one goal. And then the police department, it was a little bit more, you know, work. But work always trumped it because you had to be there. You couldn't just leave. It just wasn't something you could do.
Yeah.
So work-life balance, my life has always been work, then family. Now, it's so... Like, I didn't even know that was a real thing until I got this job. It's so much better. Like, I wake up in the morning, I go get my computer, I'll fire it up, look at emails, and kind of have breakfast with everyone. We all eat together. Then I go downstairs, get some work done. So I'm constantly home. Like, I can constantly see my daughter, see my wife. Our relationship has gotten much better because of that, just... The stress of a job is gone. There is no stress in this job either.
Really?
Zero stress.
Wow. That's not common, right?
It's not common, no. Yeah. No, it's not
common. Are you good with... Do you deal well with stress, do you think?
I do. I can deal well with stress. I still have that military mentality. You know, get up, get it done, and let's go. And when I start getting stressed, I start going into that default mode. And that doesn't work when
you're...
Like, I'll start yelling. I'll start, you know, ordering people around. I'll start, you know, I want to get the task done. So instead of being nice or being more fatherly, I don't know how to explain that, but I want to get stuff done. Like, let's get it done. And I'll start getting, I won't be as
impatient.
Nice. Yes, I get very impatient and I want to just get the task done. You know, that's the default mode that my brain works at now when I start functioning with stress.
What kinds of things do you enjoy outside of work that help bring some kind of balance to your life?
So, we were just talking about this, smoking, doing barbecue. I love barbecue. I think it's just being down in the South, being in Texas, being in Arkansas, living in the Midwest. It's a different lifestyle. It's a lifestyle that I've never knew in Connecticut. Connecticut is a very high pace, get stuff done. It's kind of like an offshoot of New York. That lifestyle is calm, blues, barbecue, and bourbon. I mean, that's the three B's. I mean, that's what you do. I like all those
things.
I do too. I love bourbon. I love barbecue.
I wish it were later in the day when it would be appropriate to be drinking it right now.
It's not a problem.
Yeah.
So that kind of lifestyle, I loved, and I like to bring that in. And the best part about this job is when I'm writing reports and I'm home all day, I can go smoke a pork butt and let that go and kind of do both of those at the same time.
Yeah.
Because it takes, you know, hours, like 12 hours. So I love doing barbecue. During the summertime, it's like every week we're smoking something. I love cooking, too.
You've got to invite me over for that.
Let's do it.
I really love cooking. I like to think I'm like an amateur chef.
Me, too. You know, and it's funny. I tell my wife, too. Like, when I retire, I want to go to culinary school. But I don't want to work in the restaurant business. I never, ever. Like, I love cooking. I have so much fun cooking meals, doing different things, but I would never want to work as a chef because I don't want to cook day in and day out.
Saturday. Yeah, no, I agree. I'm the same way. Plus, I've heard that that's like one of the worst industries.
I can imagine.
Like high stress and terrible hours and all that.
Yeah, I don't want to do that. But I love, yeah, cooking is fun. Photography, I started
doing. Oh, yeah?
Yeah, so when I was taking my bachelor's program, you had to do an arts class. Like, that was just something you had to do. So I figured, you know what? It was summer. It was a summer class I was taking. So I said, hey, I'll take photography. Never had any interest in it. So instead of buying a book, they said buy an SLR camera, one of those single-lens reflectives. It's like $500, but that's what books would cost for a semester. So they said, you know, buy one of those. And we just did that. That's all we did. We went out and shot in different parks, and I absolutely fell in love with it. It was just the best thing. It's just, like, so calm and relaxing. And I think that's the only creative thing that I do is photography.
Still, you do it?
Yeah, I still now with my daughter, we like to take a lot more photos and stuff. But yeah. I think iPhones really killed a lot of my photography. Like, I don't like breaking out the big camera because I don't want to be that guy at, you know, family events and stuff. You have that huge camera when people just have iPhones. So I did lose a lot of that, but I still try to do that as much as I can.
Yeah.
At least holidays and stuff like that, or pumpkin picking, whenever we go, I'll bring out the SLR and start shooting.
Yeah.
And working with the police department, this is a funny story. It's not actually funny at all. They had a 1 week course to be a crime scene photographer, and I told them that I love photography. I ended up getting the class, so I'm a certified crime scene photographer.
Are you really?
Yeah. So we did that, but there's nothing creative about crime scene photography.
It's
mostly
documentary. Take a picture of this corpse here.
Yeah, and all that kind of stuff. So
do you kind of understand or have sympathy for people who think work is kind of just like, I don't know, I just think our society is kind of in a funk with work.
It is.
You know, it's like, that's why I kind of like doing this podcast and talking to people about how they're dealing with work and life and all that stuff. And it's really, I don't find it common where I meet people who can honestly say they have a good work-life balance.
I never did until I had this job, and it's only been going 2 years. And I know this job is not going to last forever just because of the pay scale. I know I can't stay at this level for the rest of my life. So right now I'm basically just enjoying it. Taking it in and learning from it. What I say to everybody, I still talk to, you know, some officers or people that don't like their job. I said, well, if you don't like your situation, change it. It's that simple. It's really not that hard. Yeah. I wasn't enjoying what I was doing. It was getting very difficult. It was taking a toll on my life. So what did I do? You change it. Whatever you have to do, take that one step at a time and change your life. It's not that difficult.
Yeah.
It's a very simple step to do.
It, well, you know, maybe on paper it is, but I think it's funny that you say that, because I think the people that I know that especially are unhappy with their career are people who've been in that career for a long time. You know, like 8-10 years. Never really made a step out and done something different. Because it's really, you know, the unknown is scary.
It's terrifying. It is. It's terrifying.
You know, and a lot of times people will know what they want to excel or move up, but it's also giving up that comfort.
Exactly. And that's the hardest thing, is stepping out of that comfort zone. If you know you're in a situation you don't like, change it. I mean, what is it going to do? Is it going to be worse or is it going to be better? You can always change your situation. It doesn't have to be by a lot or anything like that, but you just need to change your situation. That's the way I see it. And I think doing the military, walking into that huge unknown, coming from a high school student, walking into that, it really did prepare me just to take that leap to something different if you don't like what you're doing.
Yeah, I think that, well, it's clear that you recognize the benefit that being in the military kind of really set you up properly in a lot of ways, right? In terms of expectations of what work, how to approach it. But do you think outside of that, do you think our society has a realistic expectation about work and what it should create for people? If your daughter now is, what, 3 or 4 years old?
Yeah, 3 and a half, about.
When she's older, like, how do you think people should approach work?
It's a good question. You should definitely have some kind of idea of where you want to go and what you want to do, first of all. And I think that should start in high school. So I think a lot of people, what they do is they know that they have to go to college because either your parents didn't go, you have to go, and they just go and they have no idea what they really want to do. So I think really focusing in on one field is going to be a big one. So have an idea of what you want to do. I always knew I wanted to do law enforcement or something in that field. Mm-hmm. And then I took the steps to get me in that field. There was no, like, 100% I was going to be a police officer. I knew I wanted to do that. If I wanted to be a police officer and that's it, I'd still be doing that. And that's not really what I want to do. So what I would tell my daughter is to find a field that you want to go into and go in with an approach that life is ever changing and so is your career, that you can change at any second. Life can change at any second. And you can do what you want to do. If your goal was to be a nurse and you don't like that, then you can kind of veer off and figure something else out from there. But don't keep it so rigid that, you know, I'm going to be a police officer and that's it.
Yeah.
Keep that open mind of there's other things out there that you don't even know about when you're 18 years old. You know nothing. You know zero when you're 18.
Yeah.
Do the job that you wanted to do that you set out, but keep your eyes open. Don't keep this tunnel vision goal set, you know, 5-year goal. I don't like these long-term goals because it puts blinders on you. You really need to keep that open mind, and you never know what's going to come up. I didn't even know this job existed and I got into it.
Absolutely true.
And I meet people every day, and I'll talk to them. I know what they do, and you can kind of veer off. You might find something that you thought was an awesome job when you were 18, 19, 20, that when you have a family is no longer going to fit your lifestyle. So you need to be dynamic. You need to be able to stop and change paths at any second.
So what about someone who's 35 and thinks it's too late? You know, a lot of people think when at our age, like the mid 30s, like you can't make a change. You can't.
It's hard. Yeah. I mean, even for me to make a change, I mean, I have a master's in justice administration. So if I wanted to go do something in the medical field, I mean, my whole entire life has got me to this point.
Mm-hmm.
So really know what you want to do, but you can change at any time. You can start taking classes. You can just change. You don't have to stay doing what you don't want to do.
Yeah. It is a simple thing, but it's also really difficult for some people to break
that. I get
it. You know?
I get it. Everybody does possess it. It's who actually uses it. There's not one person in the world that can't just change their life. I mean, everyone possesses that.
Everyone has the ability.
They have the ability. It's just, do you have the courage to just do it?
The courage, yeah.
And like I said, it doesn't have to be a big step. I'm not saying quit your job tomorrow and jump into law school. That's a ridiculous thing. That you can't do that. Take those small steps.
Yeah.
Find that job that you know, start applying for jobs. You don't have to quit your job. Just start applying. That's what I did.
Yeah.
I didn't like my situation, so I started applying for other jobs.
Yeah, and the other thing about work-life balance and is there such a thing, we also have to kind of come to terms with the fact that work is a big part of our lives.
It is.
And a lot of people will say, well, work is just work. I can leave work at work and that all that stuff. But realistically, it's a big part of our lives. So
it's 8 hours of your day.
Yeah.
That's
if
a
you're
huge
not,
chunk.
if it's not fulfilling to you, then you got to make the change.
Absolutely.
Do you think that work defines you or that it should?
So a lot of times I always say, take this test. When you talk to somebody and you say, you know, who are you? If the first thing they say is,
they're John.
I'm John and I'm a lawyer or I'm an attorney. I'm a doctor. That person is, that's who they define themselves as. But if you ask, you know, who am I? I'm a father. I'm a husband. And then, you know, work is kind of an offshoot of what I actually am. That's who defines. So a lot of times the people will define themselves when you ask them and they explain what they do. If they automatically tell you what they do, I mean, that's basically all they have is that.
Yeah.
So I would say never define yourself as your job. Jobs change, but who you are as a person is really...
Yeah.
It sounds very cliche, but it really is.
Yeah. So you have a 3.5-year-old daughter.
Yes.
How has becoming a father changed you?
It's changed me dramatically. So I was, when I first got out of college in 2009, I was applying for all sorts of police jobs. I always wanted to do state police. I applied for that, but the VA came out first and offered me a job. I did that for about 2 years, and I was like, you know what? Let me call the state police. I passed their tests. I did all that. But I turned the job down. So I called them back up and I said, hey, is that job still open? Like, are you still taking people? And they said, yes, actually, we are still taking people. So I went through the whole process, passed the background, polygraph, did all that. We found out Sarah was pregnant and they were offering me a job. And the academy started and I would be 3 months, Sarah wouldn't have me, and you know she'd be pregnant, and then the baby would be born, and then I'd have another 3 months of the academy.
Mm-hmm.
And they told me that you can only go home, see your baby born, and then you'd have to come back. And at the time, just being you know, the brand new father. I said, no, that's not going to happen. I can't do that. That's just not something I'm willing to do. So almost instantaneously, having this baby, she wasn't even born yet, I turned down a job that, you know, I set my goal for, is to be a state police. And being a father, it changes everything. It really does. And being a husband, like, you learn that life is much more important than the job you do. Yes, mm-hmm. job, you know, it's going to keep a roof over your head and all that, but family's going to come first. And you really learn that when you have a baby, because there is just no other choice but to.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you want to spend time with them. You want to, you know, hear their first words. You want to do all that. You want to be home for that.
So work kind of becomes more of just work once you're...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say yes.
I feel like that's a healthy thing, right?
It really is. It's a reality check that... And I always try to explain to people who don't have kids what it actually means. I always say, like, it's the best thing that'll ever happen to you in your lifetime. Any other experience you've ever had prior to having a baby, prom night, wedding day, all that is just completely trumped the day that you have a baby. It changes everything. And I remember being 19 in the military, and all these guys were having babies, and they would just disappear. They wouldn't be at the bars anymore. You're like, where are you? They're like, I'm home with my kids. And you're like, God, yeah. This guy, yeah. But then, like, once you do that, you realize that that is everything. It's like you have your dog, Charlie, right? You love that dog.
Yeah.
There would be days, like, when we had, like, we loved our dogs. We had two of them, and we still do. But they became, like, so, your love for your child is, like, 1,000 times more than any animal, any person. It's an incredible feeling to have. Yeah. And that's the only way I can explain it, is if you have, you know, an animal or your wife or something that you love, it's just 10 times any of that.
Just amplified.
Yeah. It's a ridiculous amount.
Because there's people who I know that are fathers, and they are workaholics too.
I don't know.
Is that possible to...
I guess it is possible, but, I mean, it wouldn't be possible for me. I just... No.
So, I think you answered this to some extent with your dad, and I know your parents so well, but I'm just wondering, how has your upbringing affected your view of work?
So, it's a funny question. So, my dad always, you know, he's from Italy. I think he got here when he was 13 years old. And that's all he ever talks about, is, like, he worked from the day he got here until now. Like, he's old. I mean, like, 63, probably. And I remember as a child, like, he would work Monday through Saturday, 12-hour shifts, nonstop. That's all he did. On Sundays, he'd be working at the house. Like, he never stopped working.
But he was, like, a carpenter.
Yeah, carpenter. He just electrician. Never... Yeah, and I think that's just his personality. He just likes to work. He's just a worker. Like, that's his type of person. Like,
this retirement and his future soon,
I guess. 65, right? 60.
My dad's retiring this April.
But would they actually retire, or are they going to still do stuff, like, nonstop, like the old Italians, like, always be in the yard just doing stuff even when it doesn't need to be done? Like,
yeah,
that's their mentality, and that's what I grew up always watching. So
yeah,
it definitely helps. I mean, your parents are huge. I remember, it's funny, when I was out of school for a while, I had a kidney operation, and when my mom had to do something, she would leave me with your mom.
Yep.
And I have a distinct memory of being in your basement, and she'd be sewing. She was a sewer. She'd have a cigarette hanging out of her mouth, and she would never stop working. Like, she was always, like, I would be there, like, talking with her, watching TV, but she was always sewing something. Like, she would never stop working either.
No.
Like, that's just their mentality. Do you remember your mom sitting down at that little thing with her little Singer sewing machine?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, like, that's all we knew. Like, it's just working, 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 and that's all you did.
Yeah. Work. And I think we're very similar in how we were raised. And I just feel, like, really, really diligent about every task. Like, exactly. I'm really, I don't know, it's just, my work ethic is so strong because of how we were raised.
Exactly.
Like, it's like an embarrassment if you're not good at your job.
Exactly.
And you don't take it, you don't know any other way.
Exactly.
It's just normal.
Exactly.
Is there, because I know you've listened to a few episodes, is there anything that you wanted to talk about that we didn't, that you think you have kind of a unique perspective that you wanted to bring in here?
So, yeah, really quickly, I wanted to tell you this story. So when I got into the military, you know, I always wanted to do the military. I signed up a year before I even got out of, I signed up, I think it was my junior year, late junior year, early sophomore year of high school.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah, it was called the delayed entry program. So I wanted to do that. I was so excited to do that. And then as time got closer, you know, you started being like, okay, it's go time. I'm going in.
Yeah.
So then I go in, and I was telling Sarah the story. We were driving behind, I believe it was like a dump truck, and I smelled this diesel smell, and it almost instantly brings me back to the military. And it was, I believe November, it was the a week before my birthday, and it was 5 o'clock in the morning, and I'm sitting in the back of what they call a deuce and a half. You know what a deuce and a half is? It's this big truck, you know, the one with the canopy over it?
Yeah.
You fit like 1,000 people in the back?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's how we'd get back and forth to places. So the first hour of the day, we'd be driving out to the field to do our exercises and do all this stuff. And this thing would just drive, and it would be like, and it would shoot this diesel smoke, black smoke, into this thing. And we'd all like breathe it in.
Yeah,
so
that's safe.
That smell is so like ingrained in my head. And as soon as I smell diesel, if I'm behind an ambulance, dump truck, anything, I go almost instantly back to that.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting in the back of the deuce and a half when people were like halfway falling asleep. They had their helmets on, their rifles, and they're just...
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm thinking, what the hell am I doing? All my friends are in college. They're probably not even close to waking up. They probably just fell asleep. They might still be drunk from the night before.
Right.
And here I am, you know, 18 years old. My birthday is in 2 days. And I'm in the back of this thing. Like, what am I doing? Like, why did I pick this path? And to this day, knowing where I came from, like, I wish I can go back to that 18-year-old kid and just say, it's going to be worth it, you know? Because now, when I smell that smell and I go back to that spot and I think of that question I was asking myself as I was, you know, driving out to the field once again, you know, over yeah. and over and over doing this stuff that was just beyond what I wanted to do, it reminds me where I am today. And you just wish you can go back to your old self and just say, you know, it's going to be worth it. You know, every time you smell that smell, it instantly brings me back to being 18, 2 days before my birthday. I specifically remember sitting there just thinking, why don't I just go to college like everybody else?
Yeah, but it seems like there's not one thing that you would change.
Exactly. So, and what I would like to tell everybody and bring to this program is that at this time, this might be your deuce and a half moment. You know, why am I in this job? I hate this job. You know, why am I doing this? Why am I here? Hopefully 10 years from today, you can look back and be like, you know what? That's why I was in that job, because I met this person who got me there. So another really cliche thing, everything happens for a reason, or, you know?
Yeah.
Where you are today, even if it's an absolute horrible position, you're sitting in a deuce and a half, breathing in diesel smoke, heading out to the field, you know, again.
Yeah.
That's where it got me here. That's why I'm here, where I am here. So hopefully anybody who hates their job is in that position understands that this might be your deuce and a half moment or
I love
something
it.
Like that.
It's awesome.
So.
Thanks again for coming up.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
And yeah, I think it's great and people will be really happy to listen to your story. And I think you have a perspective that was totally missing from the show. And I'm excited to publish it.
Awesome.
Have it
glad
out there.
To be here.
Yeah, man. All right. So from the title of the episode, you could tell that I was most intrigued by John's meal-by-meal approach. You know, this was a mind-opener for me. And as you heard in our conversation, this strategy, which John implemented during his basic training in San Antonio, it helped him and members of his flight get through what was an extremely difficult and demanding time while avoiding being overcome by fear or anxiety or just that I can't do this kind of thing that we all kind of find ourselves falling into at one time or another. This approach is something I think we can all benefit from. And it was great to hear how John used this strategy to get him through not just the military, not just basic training, but to get through college. And ultimately, it helped him advance his career. Another thing I gained from this conversation is what John calls a deuce and a half moment. And some of you listening may find yourself in an unhappy or unfulfilling career at this moment. And I'm hopeful that by listening to John, that maybe inspired you to make a change. And remember, it's just to take small bites, meal by meal. It really was such a pleasure talking with you, John. And I consider you family, and I cannot be more proud of the kind of man you've become. And I really want to say thank you again for coming up and recording and sharing your story. It's a great benefit to everyone, I'm sure. Before I go, I would like to mention a new Where I Work Facebook page. You can simply go to Facebook and in the search bar, just type in Where I Work. And from there, you could find all kinds of content, like links to other podcasts, links to articles that I'm reading, mostly about work-life balance, and just hopefully get a conversation going on there. So I hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you did, please spread the word.